Your support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients a solution for failed root canal treated teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. There are box scores in the paper today. On most late summer mornings, that would not be news, but until yesterday afternoon, the possibility of a strike that would have shut down Major League Baseball again hung over the game. The tension of that circumstance had begun to work on at least some of the players, especially those serving as player representatives, communicating news from the negotiating table to their teammates. In St. Louis, that was the responsibility of Cardinal relief pitcher Steve Kline.
A lot of my reputation has been probably destroyed. You know, people probably think that I'm some egotistical maniac. My militant style for this is just because I don't see in the gray area. I see black or white. So I just like pitching, man. It's either be loved or be hated. There's no, in the middle.
Numbers of baseball fans were also tense, and as the strike deadline established by the players drew near, some of them expressed their frustration at the ballpark. After Wednesday night's game in Anaheim, Tampa Bay Devil Rays outfielder Ben Grieve tried to make the best of an evening that saw fans throwing back foul balls and littering the field with trash and cash.
I guess it could have been worse. They threw a few things out there, but luckily I don't think they were aiming for anybody. I think their point was just to throw it on the field.
One assumes that nobody at the games last night threw anything onto the field but bouquets, because yesterday's agreement between the owners and the players meant that for the first time since the owners and players began negotiating 30 years ago, a new contract was achieved without an interruption of play. At a 1 p.m. press conference announcing that agreement, Major League Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig was moved to make reference to a song most of the players might be too young to remember, though baseball's aging fan base probably knows it well.
I'm fond of quoting the Beatles song about a long and winding road, and this has been a long, very difficult and winding road, spanning over 3-plus decades. But at least today, we were able to do what hasn't been done before. And hopefully that spirit and all the energy that's gone to this will be channeled in the right directions, and that baseball, the greatest game in the world, and all its fans will be the beneficiary of this.
As is the case with most negotiated agreements, both sides can also make a beneficiary's claim. The owners can be satisfied that they've expanded the function of the luxury tax and more firmly established the reality of revenue sharing in their game, developments they claim are necessary to competitive balance and the survival of several franchises. The players can point to the fact that their game still has no salary cap as such, that their freedom to become free agents has not been compromised, and that contraction, which the commissioner seemed determined to achieve, has been averted. Rest easy, Montreal, Minnesota, Tampa Bay. No players' jobs have been eliminated. All this meant that yesterday, Donald Fehr negotiating for the players could be just as optimistic as Commissioner Selig.
It's been a very long time since a collective bargaining agreement in baseball has been negotiated without a work stoppage. And what we can now hope for is that it will be a very long time before a collective bargaining agreement is negotiated after a work stoppage. All streaks come to an end, and this is one that was overdue to come to an end.
Bargaining, even when it's between parties that don't have a history of rancorous failure, tends to obscure the fact that both sides have a stake in returning to business, especially when the business at issue has been profitable for both sides. B.J. Surhoff, who plays for the Atlanta Braves, found in yesterday's agreement an opportunity to remind fans that the players were as anxious as anyone for the season to go on.
One thing people don't really realize is players are fans, too. They wanted to get this thing done. We wanted to try and work out a resolution, and we stayed at it hard, and they stayed at it hard. And, ultimately we got the deal done, and now we're going to move forward and put the focus back on going into September and hopefully a great postseason again.
Easy for him to say. He plays for a team leading its division by almost 20 games. Still, yesterday afternoon, there was a sense of relief throughout the perhaps dwindling community of people who care about Major League Baseball. Outside Fenway Park, a Red Sox fan named Ray Giacovelli expressed more confidence than many of his fellow fans felt.
I never lost faith in the game. The game is bigger than any team, any owner, or any player. And I don't think anything could happen to the game of baseball. Just a great game.
It was a sentiment that would fall sweetly on the ears of Commissioner Bud Selig, who's probably heard enough about how angry his game's business issues have made fans to last a lifetime, or at least a term in office. That might explain why the commissioner said yesterday that he felt the settlement might have caught lots of fans by surprise.
I think there were a lot of people who never believed they'd live long enough to see these two parties come together, make a very meaningful deal, and do it without one game of work stoppage. This was a day that many people never believed would happen. And it did, and so for a lot of reasons, I'm very grateful today. Very grateful.
During the 1994 baseball strike, fan sentiment went overwhelmingly against the players. This year, there seemed to be an equal amount of disdain for players and team owners, at least through yesterday. One example of this phenomenon could be found in East Texas, where readers of the Huntsville Item, a daily paper, have enjoyed a Bud Selig and Donald Fehr free zone since Sunday. Baseball coverage resumes this morning. Joining me now on the line is Huntsville Item managing editor David Arkin. Welcome to Only a Game, Mr. Arkin.
Thanks for having me.
Are you going to miss the fun of having the baseball labor management news come across your desk and then being able to just toss it in the trash can?
Well, I'm sure there's parts of it that I will miss, parts that I won't miss. I think, starting probably tomorrow, I'll end up being able to be the editor of this newspaper again and not, not on 20 million radio and television stations. But I know it's been a lot of fun. We've really enjoyed kind of the experience here. It's been a little bit different to be on the opposite end, if you will. But, it's been an interesting week here in Little Huntsville, Texas.
So by opposite end, you mean you're among the covered rather than among the covering?
Yeah, it's a little odd to be given quotes instead of, asking for them. So, but it's been fun.
Now, how did it happen that the Huntsville Item became a labor management free zone, at least as far as baseball was concerned?
Well, I guess probably about a week and a half ago, we were, sitting around after deadline, and two of the editors came with the idea, what would happen if we, didn't cover baseball and just pulled it from our newspaper. And so that is pretty much exactly what we decided to do. We decided to go ask the readers what they thought. We thought that we, shouldn't have the right, basically, to pull something of entertainment out of the newspaper without asking the readers what they thought. And so we decided to do a poll and asked readers to, wrote a couple of columns and asked readers to send us their comments, email us, fax us, do whatever. And 82% of them said that they could really pretty much care less if baseball was in the newspaper. And so we decided to pull the coverage.
Now, are you aware of any other newspapers or perhaps other media outlets that took up your cue?
Yeah, there's a paper actually in Athens, Texas, which is in North Texas, and they're actually owned by the same company that we're owned by, and they ended up doing the exact same thing. They emailed us on Wednesday and said that they were pulling their coverage, and that was kind of neat. There have been a lot of media that have, radio stations really more than newspapers that have applauded us for, doing this and saying that they wish their newspapers in their towns would do the same thing. So not a whole lot of other papers, jumping on the bandwagon with us, but at least a lot of other radio stations, other media, maybe, I don't know if they support the idea, but maybe more fascinated with the idea might be the right way to put it.
Well, you've got two full-time sports reporters there, right?
That's correct.
Now, what did they do during the baseball-free zone establishment?
They've been working their butt off is what they've been doing. One of our reporters was in Central Michigan yesterday covering – we had Sam Houston State University is here, and he was covering the Bearcats football team up there, first game of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And this week, football season kicked off on Friday night. So they were very busy covering, Friday night football games. We cover some, seven area high school teams. Two guys do, basically. We have some stringers. For those that aren't familiar with Texas, football is huge out this way, and they kept plenty busy. We, still had the issue of the talk in some of our editors' meetings that there still wasn't enough room even pulling out baseball stuff. So it was a busy week for them.
Well, I wonder if they'll miss the baseball free zone policy.
Well, on Friday during our budget meeting, our editor, somebody said, "Who are the Astros playing?" And one of the editors said, "Who cares?" maybe the attitudes here have changed a bit after a week without baseball. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, we can probably manage without this. Now, if this would happen in June, we would have been in trouble. This has been very difficult to do in June. But, you know, I mean, in the end of August, and when, you know, football starting here, it really wasn't as hard to do as you might think.
Well, having gotten out front on the sort of baseball-free zone there at the paper, are you kind of considering that possibility in regard to any other subjects, sports or otherwise?
Sports-wise, possibly. You know, it would have to be something along these lines again. Sports is, the way I view it, sports is different than news because sports isn't news. It's entertainment. But baseball is just a big movie. You know, somebody asked me this week, I think on one of the TV stations, if the Mideast, something was going on with the Mideast, and, you know, our readers didn't want it in the newspaper, would we pull it? Well, no, we wouldn't, because that's national interest, completely different than, you know, a sporting event. So we would never pull news. It's not that we don't view news as important as sports, but it's two separate things. I'm sure our sports editor would argue that sports is just as important as, you know, the front page news, but I think there is a, you know, a difference in what it means to the country and means to our readers.
David Arkin is managing editor of the Huntsville Item. He joined me on the line from his office and formerly Selig and Fear Free Zone in Huntsville, Texas. Mr. Arkin, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for the time. I appreciate it.
You see, I grew up believing that the game was played for free by men who really knew the score of how lucky they could be. Dance across the grass just cut, the smell can set you free. To run around the bases is still all I ever need. So excuse me for sounding sentimental in a song. I had no intention to sing about what's wrong. As McGuire and Mark.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. In the middle of Wales, there is a bog, and in the middle of the bog, there were, believe it or not, some snorkelers, 87 of them, in fact, and there emerged two champion bog snorkelers, 15-year-old Philip John from Bridge End, South Wales, and 18-year-old Gemma Davies of Tonypandy, South Wales. Each of them slogged along a 60-yard trench cut through the bog using a snorkel and flippers more quickly than anybody else could do it. In the process, they raised money for the Mid Wales Division of the Cystic Fibrosis Trust, which redeems what I suppose would otherwise have been an utterly filthy story.
Mud, glorious mud, nothing quite like it for cooling the blood. So follow me, follow, down to the hollow, and there let us wallow in glorious mud. The fair hippopotamus.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. To read more about the averted baseball strike and the deal that saved the season, log on to WBUR.org and click on News. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Wellington Management Company, providing investment advice to clients worldwide, and by 170 Systems, providing solutions in content management, document management, and business process enhancement for the Oracle database and the Oracle eBusiness Suite on the web at 170systems.com. Today starts out cloudy, then mostly sunny, breezy this afternoon, high 65 to 70. Clear and cool tonight, lows 50 to 55. Tomorrow, partly sunny, highs in the upper 60s. Monday, Labor Day, partly sunny, highs 70 to 75. There is a slight chance of rain on the Cape and the Islands on Labor Day. 64 degrees in Boston right now, 64 at Martha's Vineyard at 720.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, a preview of the most exciting college football season ever. But first, did the country's most successful athletes union take a hit yesterday? Perhaps nobody is better qualified to answer that question than Charles Corr, the author of a new book entitled The End of Baseball as We Knew It, The Players' Union, 1960 to 1981. Charles Corr is a professor of history at the University of Missouri in St. Louis, and he joins me now from the studios of member station KWMU, also in St. Louis. Charles Corr, welcome to Only a Game.
Well, thanks very much. I'm really looking forward to talking with you.
At several points in the end of baseball as we knew it, you demonstrate that none of baseball's strikes were isolated events. In each case, the players struck to protect what they had previously achieved through bargaining. Have the players lost anything in yesterday's agreement?
I don't think they've lost anything. They've maintained the general status. Well, most of all, both sides recognize that they couldn't afford 1994-95 again. And I think this is probably one of the first labor agreements that is a win-win situation for both sides. And I think what both sides recognize today is that both sides have an awful lot to lose. So both of them are now protecting what they currently have.
So the inclusion of the language and the concept of revenue sharing and the language and the concept of luxury tax, these do not constitute a loss as far as you're concerned for the players?
I don't think so. First of all, they went along with those principles in 95, or actually in 96 in the contract that ended the 95 strike. So this is why all along I have thought that there would not be a work stoppage this time. I thought that there was going to be an agreement because this is the first bargaining that's taken place between the two sides in 35 years where they were not arguing over absolutes. They weren't arguing over principles. What they were trying to do was refine the numbers. This also, by the way, is unique in another way, another respect. This is the first time that the majority of the fans and a large majority of the press has said a plague on both your houses. I've looked extensively at the press coverage over the last 30 years, and every single time the players either went on strike or threatened to go on strike or they were locked out, every single time the vast majority of the press and the fans supported the owners. And this goes back to 1972 when, if you can believe this, the Baltimore fans booed Brooks Robinson on opening day.
Absolutely.
St. Louis fans booed Joe Torre,
right,
who had just come off an MVP season. And the reason in both cases was the same thing. They had been very active in the union. There had been a short strike. The fans were unforgiving. And I have to admit, the baseball press and the press in general has been just as unforgiving.
Marvin Miller, the head of the Players Association during its most dramatically active days, emerges as an enormously admirable character in your book. Is there anybody in the current cast of union characters of that stature?
There's nobody of that stature, and that doesn't say anything about Führer Orza, who are both very bright guys, and Don's stewardship of the union, and after all, he's been the executive director longer than Miller was. I don't think anybody, other than a few owners who feel like they keep losing, can argue with just how well the union has been run since Miller. But the difference is that Marvin was a trailblazer. He was a pioneer. He was chosen by a group of players who decided that something was wrong with baseball. They weren't exactly sure what it was, but players like Jim Bunning and Robin Roberts knew that something had to be changed, and it was Miller's job to, first of all, educate the players to take responsibility for their own lives. Mm. Marvin's been accused of a lot of things, all of which I think are untrue. It's of taking advantage of the players, leading them around by the nose, brainwashing them. Marvin is a very talented negotiator, but most of all, Marvin is a superb teacher. And I don't mean in terms of somebody who stands up in front of a group and lectures them. Marvin probably would run great seminars. Each individual player, when they would talk to Marvin, felt, and I think they were right in so feeling, that he cared about their own problem. He wanted to understand their problem. There are a couple of other people, though, that I think come out of the book as very admirable figures. The one who has gotten no credit and is probably forgotten totally was a man named John Guerin, who was the owner's negotiator for 10 years from 1966 to 1976. He had probably one of the most difficult jobs in American industry because he was working for 24, 26 men, each of whom not only thought that they knew his job better than he did, but as Guerin described it to me, each of them thought they were the smartest man in America. And every time Guerin tried to bargain a compromise for the owners, a compromise that the players would accept, he was told, no compromise, we've always won in the past, we're going to win now. Well, they always lost.
In the current climate of very high salaries and free agency, it's easy, maybe it's easy, to forget what the players faced before they were organized. Your story of how Mickey Mantle was coerced into signing his contract after the 1956 season may educate some folks about how bad those good old days were.
Well, Mantle went to the general manager and wanted a significant raise, and the general manager told him that after all, he was still a young player. He would get his money later. The Yankees didn't think he was worth it. And by the way, in case you really wanted to cause trouble, Mickey, you wouldn't want us to leak the reports of the private detective we've had following you. You wouldn't want those leaked publicly, or you wouldn't want your wife to know what you've been doing. Well, what choice did Mantle have? The reserve system said that he couldn't go where he wanted. And the whole purpose of the union from 1966 on, and the whole purpose of Miller's job, was to change the rules of the game.
You've written a good deal in your book about fan sentiment, and of course people have talked about it in connection with the strike that was averted yesterday. What do you think happens in the climate of a successful negotiation with no work stoppage? Do fans continue to attend baseball as they have been, or does attendance go up because they're so pleased that it's still there?
I think it'll probably not go up very much. I think there are a few fans that might have been not going recently because they were angry, but I think they will probably just say, well, why did you take so much time out of my life? I'm still not going to go. Attendance will go up over the next few weeks, but I think it'll have nothing to do with the strike. It'll be because there's some very good pennant races. And that's the thing that I have found the most confounding about baseball and ownership's approach towards promoting the sport over the last 30 years. I've been watching baseball since 1945, and as far as I'm concerned, since 1976, increasingly so, we've been going through the golden age of baseball. I mean, the performances on the field now are just superb. Last year, we had probably the best World Series in at least a decade. I mean, how can people spend all of this time, people in baseball, spend so much time trying to remind themselves and us all that's wrong with baseball? So in that respect, I think having a settlement now might bring some more people back to the ballpark because maybe they won't open the paper each day and be told what's wrong with baseball.
As somebody who's been paying a great deal of attention, both as a scholar and a fan, to the relationship between labor and management in baseball since 1960, what do you think relationships between those two groups will be like for the next 20 years?
I wouldn't want to take a stab at the next 20 years. I'm glad that for the next 4 years we're going to have a settlement in place. I actually think this is the basis for something I wished would have happened years ago, but I could understand why it didn't. And that's an ongoing conversation between the union and management as to what the problems baseball are. So we might be able to come up with a blueprint for solving some of them before we reach a crisis. And I think one of the ways that we can accomplish that is the existence of the current commissioner. Now, I have a lot of problems for Bud Selig's presentation of things. I have some problems for his efforts in the past. One of the things, and I'm saying this also as a fan, one of the things that I think has been an enormously positive development is having a commissioner who everybody understands is an owner and works for the owners. The myth that over the years the commissioner was some kind of impartial, neutral, a pater familias for baseball, that the players knew that was never the case. But it stood in the way of honest, open negotiations and bargaining. Well, nobody can ever think that Bud Selig is anything but the CEO of ownership. And I think once you have a recognition of that, that both sides can appoint a committee or have a kind of ongoing situation where they can hopefully resolve problems before they become problems. So, yes, I'm very optimistic for a whole bunch of reasons about the future of baseball.
Charles Kuhr is the author of The End of Baseball as We Knew It, just published by the University of Illinois Press. Professor Kuhr, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Well, thank you. This has been a real pleasure.
Now, to help us cleanse the sports palate of baseball, I welcome Bob Cohn, who covers college football as well as various other matters for The Washington Times. Bob, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hi, Bill. Good to talk to you again.
All right. This is the earliest we've talked to you about college football because college football is starting earlier than ever before.
Yeah, I think we're at the mid-season point of the season now.
It is beginning to feel that way. Some teams could play 15 games this season. Are we going to one day see games in July?
Hopefully not. You know, it's really interesting and in some ways typical of the NCAA. We've been hearing for years the rationale for not having a playoff is that they don't want to overextend the quote-unquote student athletes by pushing the season forward. So what they've done is they pushed the season back into August and created the situation where, like you say, some teams might play 15 games, typical of the NCAA, known a little bit for its hypocrisy. I will say, however, that next year that should change because they've eliminated the so-called preseason games like the kickoff classic.
One of the things that people start talking about as soon as they start talking about college football is, of course, the Heisman race. Should we be paying attention to that this early?
Well, no, just as we shouldn't be talking about who's number one in August. But, of course, we do because that's the basis of college football.
That's football talk.
It's polls. It's all polls. It's all voting. It's all a beauty pageant. You obviously can't determine the Heisman Trophy winner on the field, you know, with a punt, pass, and kick competition, just as you can't determine the true number one team on the field, as far as I'm concerned.
One thing people are saying about this season is that the quarterback crop is extremely lush. Got a lot of great quarterbacks in college out there this season, right?
Oh, yeah. We start with the obvious choice. That's, of course, Rex Grossman, and then it goes on to Ken Dorsey of Miami. And my personal favorite is Byron Leftwich from Marshall. Mm-hmm. Partially because he's from Washington, D.C., which is now my hometown, but also because he's a terrific football player, maybe the best player in the country, plays for the team with what I think is the best nickname in all of sports, the Thundering Herd.
Oh, that's very nice.
Marshall.
Because Woody Herman's band used to be called that.
Woody Herman played second base for the Red Sox?
Yeah, some indication of how old I am, I acknowledge. There are a lot of coaches being watched closely by media and fans as this season begins. Tyrone Willingham, who starts the season as the first black coach in the history of Notre Dame. Two legends, Bobby Bowden of Florida State and Joe Paterno of Penn State, probably near the end of their careers.
Well, maybe not.
Maybe not. But which coaching story intrigues you most at this point?
Oh, it's got to be Ron Zook at Florida replacing the evil genius Steve Spurrier. I can't think of another coach who has been credited with creating a, and I'm going to put another word in quotes, system, and building a program as Steve Spurrier. He certainly deserves a lot of that credit. Florida was, was a struggling program on NCAA probation when he took over. He turned him into a power by virtue of his offensive genius, I guess, for lack of a better word. And as you mentioned, the Bowden-Paterno chase to see who finishes with the most victories in college football history. What I'd like to see is them somehow end up in a tie and then both retire, sharing the record. But that's not going to happen.
Well, that would be a little shady if they were to conspire to finish with the same record, wouldn't it?
I think it would be fitting because I believe there are questions now, especially in Penn State's case, about whether Coach Paterno and his contributions are legendary, and we don't even need to explain them. I think everybody knows what they are. At this point, perhaps hasn't lost a little bit of his fastball in terms of recruiting, in terms of just the overall direction of the program. It's going to be another interesting year for Penn State. Florida State looks like they're back to where they were after last year's, which for them, you know, was a debacle, 8-4. But there are whispers, too, that Coach Bowden maybe lost a little touch with the program, with the players. I just read where he said he wants to coach till he dies or he wants to die on the field, which might make an interesting halftime show if they could time it right.
Bob, Duke has lost 23 consecutive games. If the Blue Devils have another perfect losing season, they will break the Division I-A record for futility set by Northwestern in the early 80s. Do we see that happening?
Circle this date, September 28th. Duke at Navy. Both teams winless last year. Navy has a new coach from the 1AA ranks at Georgia Southern, Paul Johnson, terrific coach, straight shooter. His quote today in my paper, The Washington Times, it says, if they want to hear that they're really good and really special, they've got the wrong cat. There's positive reinforcement.
Okay. All right. So we're not going to see Duke or Navy contend this year, but who will contend?
Certainly the usual suspects. Everybody likes Oklahoma, Miami, Texas, Tennessee, Florida State, of course. Don't see any real surprises now, but of course, who does? Who envisioned Maryland having the year they had last year? It's safe to say right now that those teams and the teams that are always up in the top 10 are probably going to be back again.
Bob Cohn covers college football for the Washington Times and is a regular Hulks of Harvest Time soothsayer for Only a Game. Thanks again, Bob.
Bill, can I mention one more thing?
Absolutely.
Okay, I know every year we sort of pick out our favorite bowl game, and as you know, the NCAA saw fit to add three more bowl games.
You can never have enough bowl games.
Practically guaranteeing that every team that plays except Duke and Navy will play in a bowl game. This year, my pick is the ConAgra Foods Hawaii Bowl.
I saw that one. It's a beauty.
I have no idea what ConAgra is. I'll tell you what it sounds like. It's a drug that improves the sex drive of prison inmates. ConAgra. Think about it.
I don't think I will.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Bob Cohn, covering college football and all sorts of other things on behalf of the Washington Times and Only a Game. Thanks again, Bob.
Thank you, Bill.
For more on this week's stories, pictures from stories past and present, commentaries galore, and the opportunity to write email to us, check out our website, onlyagame.org. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter McLennan and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Direct Tire and Auto Service, winner of the 2001 Retailer of the Year Award by the Retailers Association of Massachusetts, on the web at directtire.com. Good morning, I'm Dolores Handy. In sports headlines, with a Major League Baseball strike averted, the Red Sox hit the road and staged a slugfest in Cleveland last night. A big first inning for the Sox led to a 15-5 win over the Indians. Game two of their series is tonight in Cleveland. Sox ace Pedro Martinez did not make the trip. He underwent an MRI in Boston yesterday after experiencing soreness in his shoulder. The results are expected to be available today. No word on whether he'll miss his next scheduled start Tuesday in New York. New England Patriots coach Bill Belichick had some tough decisions to make. The Patriots must cut their roster from 64 players to 53 by 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. The New England Revolution are on the road tonight playing Columbus. The New England college football season gets underway today. Among the games, Boston College hosts Connecticut, Northeastern hosts Lock Haven. Visit the public radio store, WBUR.org, where this weekend only, your purchase of a Panasonic HD TV or other select television will get you a $200 gift certificate, good at Amazon.com. The public radio store, WBUR.org, where every purchase helps pay for the news. In the forecast, today starts out cloudy, then mostly sunny, breezy, highs near 70.
WBUR and New England Toyota dealers are giving you a chance to commute to work in a super low emissions vehicle and support the news. Your $100 pledge by September 6th will enter your name into a drawing to win a gasoline electric hybrid car, a four-door 2002 Toyota Prius. Take this chance at helping the environment while supporting the news. Enter the drawing and learn more at WBUR.org or pledge now with a call to 800-909-9287.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, squash season in your garden and at Symphony Hall as well. But first, I'm joined by our analyst, Charlie Pierce, for a discussion of the week's sports news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
That grin on your face says it all. You're thrilled that there will be no interruption in the baseball season. Did these negotiations have a winner and a loser?
Shall I turn into the performing Mickey sports commentator and say the fans are really the winner because they will have baseball through the end of the season, and isn't that wonderful?
Nicely impersonated.
You know, I think probably if you're parceling out winning and losing, the owners probably – I mean, I think the question for the last 2 weeks has been whether or not the owners would take a 40% victory and go home. And that's pretty much what they did. They didn't get everything they wanted. They got more of what they wanted than they could have dreamed of getting in 1993, let's say. But I think the ultimate thing that both sides agreed on was the fact that having baseball shut down was a disaster. And I think once that global agreement was reached, the working out the fine details was just a labor negotiation.
In connection with negotiations, a couple of recent polls have demonstrated that baseball seems to be less popular than ever. Are those numbers just a reflection of dismay felt earlier this week over a possible strike?
I think that the level that the depths to which those numbers reached are. I mean, you take a poll in the middle of what appears to be the cataclysmic labor confrontation of all time, and lo and behold, a lot of the people who might not get to see baseball are angry at baseball. Forgive me while I smack the center of forehead with the palm of my hand. But baseball has some serious structural problems as a cultural institution. And one of the real problems with having this, this labor bloodletting every 4 years is that the two sides can't get together and address the problems they have in common, which is baseball's position in the world.
As some of the other pro sports leagues have done fairly efficiently and effectively.
They've managed to do it certainly more than baseball has. Yeah. I think that the one thing we need with this proposal, and I think the one thing that's a real problem with the proposal is that it doesn't guarantee that the increased revenue sharing actually goes into the product. It's time for baseball to agree upon and to appoint a special master to oversee the terms of the labor agreement. Bud Selig is compromised to the point where it's impossible for him to sneeze without angering someone. Lord knows baseball is suffused. The world of baseball is suffused with intelligent dilettantes. It's time to grab one of them and say, okay, pal, you wax romantic, you love the game, you get in here and make sure both sides live up to what they've agreed upon.
Last weekend, the New York Liberty eliminated the Washington Mystics. I will give you a final chance to say...
Have a good summer. Shamiqua Holtzclaw.
Thank you. The Liberty are now down 1-0 against the Los Angeles Sparks in the finals. They have a chance to close out the series this afternoon in L.A. Do we see the Sparks prevailing?
I do. And another win for Michael Cooper, one of my favorite players from the golden era of the Magic Johnson Los Angeles Lakers. The Sparks have too much height and too much size for the Liberty to match up with. They will win the game on the boards, and I suspect that Lisa Leslie will probably be your most valuable player this year, and I suspect the Los Angeles Sparks will put up their second straight WNBA championship, giving that particular basketball operation its fifth consecutive world championship of some kind or another.
And it's not only basketball. L.A., L.A., L.A. I mean, everywhere.
L.A., L.A., L.A.
Precisely. That's where
they sing
it
at soccer games.
What are we to make of L.A. being and California being champions in everything these days? In New York, the U.S. Open tennis tournament is underway, and I have to express my disappointment in Jennifer Capriati. This week, she admitted during a post-match press conference that she didn't know what Title IX is. Surprised?
Well, she was pretty stoned back then. It's entirely possible she lost an entire decade.
Not for 30 years.
No, I mean, people aren't aware of the sacrifices other people have made to enrich them. Shock me. Stop me if we haven't heard this story before. I suspect that there are probably, Congressman J.C. Watts, our Oklahoma, probably isn't aware of all the various machinations that produced the Voting Rights Act of 1965. I am also very disappointed in Jennifer Capriati. I wish I could say I was surprised, but I'm not.
Serena Williams is not only the player to beat this year at the U.S. Open, she's also chosen to be the person to watch. Have you seen the cat suit?
I have seen the cat suit. The cat suit is a good idea. Of course, she ran into a purported double standard when Tommy Haas was asked to remove his muscle shirt because it didn't have any sleeves. And he, of course, an issue was made of this. Of course, if Tommy Haas had anywhere near the importance to his particular side of the draw as Serena Williams does to her, I suspect he could probably wear a burlap sack.
Is it too late to mention Pete Sampras in the context of this tournament?
No, no, give him one more chance.
He's still
what the
in
heck?
There? Okay, that's
good. You know, he spent his entire career with no real opposition, and now he's starting to look very much over the hill. But it's entirely possible that he can make one more run at one more Grand Slam title. It would be this one. I'm sure the organizers are happy because it will give them something to pay attention to on the men's side of the draw.
The National Football League's preseason has ended. Have you a candidate for best prepared and least hobbled team heading into the games that count?
I have to tell you, having watched the game against the Steve Spurrier-led Washington Redskins, your defending world champion New England Patriots look extraordinarily sound, especially on defense.
In a break from NFL schedules from previous seasons, the league's first game will be played next Thursday. Is this evidence that the NFL is preparing to dominate television every night of the week, not just Sunday?
If they could find a way to put an NFL game of the night on, they would do it. It's just impractical.
More teams.
Absolutely. Well, they would have to expand to about 50 teams. Believe me, don't think it hasn't occurred to people.
Today we may see the first woman officiate a college football game. Is this progress for the NCAA?
I guess. I mean, Anise Kanade will referee the contest between Delaware State and Morris Brown, throw out the record books when these traditional rivals tee it up. I wish her luck. I wish her someday that she would be able to work a game that will be on somebody's television except the cable access in Atlanta, Georgia.
College football bowls have all sorts of sponsors, Charlie. That's been the case for years. The grounds crews at some ballparks now are sponsored by lawn care companies. But how about this development? Referees in a rugby league in Wales are now officially sponsored by a chain of opticians.
I got to tell you, you have to love the Welsh rugby referees for having a sense of humor. I mean, I think it would be funnier if, say, Major League Baseball umpires were sponsored by, oh, I don't know, Jenny Craig, but this isn't bad.
Finally, Charlie, for those expectant mothers in our audience, video game publisher Acclaim Entertainment is offering $10,000 in savings bonds to the first family to have a child tomorrow and name that child Turok, the name of the company's new game featuring dinosaurs and, of course, firearms. Is this to be a new trend in baby naming?
Well, this is going to come as something of a shock to my daughter, Donkey Kong.
Charlie Pierce, who writes for the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine and named his daughter Donkey Kong.
I did not, Molly. That's Phil saying that, not me.
Indulges in radio games for only a game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Phil.
We bought 10 books of baby names, made a long list of baby names, different names, some unique.
What do you think of Marvin or Monique?
On our top 10, now can you blame us? Names of the rich and of the famous, Rosie and Kathy Lee.
Or maybe we could name a boy after me.
We gotta find the perfect baby name.
We poked through books of baby names from A to Z. Circled names. We like Paige. We like Sage.
On our show 2 weeks ago, I talked with Mark Jenkins, who wrote a book entitled The Hard Way that chronicled his outdoor adventures. During that conversation, Mr. Jenkins casually used a common expression, the sanitized version of which might be, gosh darn. As a result, Ron Hatcher of Indianapolis wrote to say, I'll need to keep my granddaughter away from the radio, it seems, anytime I have it tuned to NPR. Of last week's story about the decision of the school board in Devil's Lake, North Dakota, to change the nickname of the high school's athletic teams to something other than the Satans, Glenn Johnson of Tallahassee, Florida, wrote to say, how about the Angels? No, a team called the Devil's Lake Angels would probably get beat up in the parking lot after the game. Funny, the baseball team in Anaheim hasn't had that problem this year. Last week's show also featured a story about a group of very ambitious runners engaged in an event called the Sri Chinmoy Self-Transcendence Race after the 72-year-old self-styled spiritual leader who claims to have lifted more than 7,000 pounds over his head. Susan Riesenberg, a WBUR listener, heard that piece and wrote, I was so moved by the story I had tears in my eyes and a lump in my throat. However, Ann Carlton of New York emailed to say, quote, I wanted to bring to your attention that Sri Chinmoy is a fake. I was a member for 20-plus years and a victim to the lies, conditioning, manipulation, and sexual abuse perpetrated by Sri Chinmoy against his disciples. He is damaging many lives by using fear and other control tactics. Several other listeners emailed with similar charges. One who did not wish her name used included articles which termed Sri Chinmoy's weightlifting claims, quote, ridiculous, and cited, quote, a long record of sexual, psychological, and financial abuse of the meditation students he collects around the world. The emailer spoke of the, quote, chronic debilitating conditions, end quote, some of those who've run in the Sri Chinmoy marathon now suffer. You can respond to what you hear on Only a Game by writing us at WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. The email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu, and you can also contact us through our website, onlyagame.org. If you call 617-353-1860, we'll get the message you leave on the listener line. It's late Wednesday morning at the Boston Racquet Club, and a tense squash match is underway. Brad Faxon, the 11th best golfer in the United States, is battling one of the country's most accomplished gourmet chefs, Ming Tsai, who owns a celebrated restaurant called Blue Ginger and hosts two shows on the Food Network. As John Nimick, the organizer of this remarkable event, learns when he addresses the opponents between games, this is serious. Mr. Faxon feels that Mr. Nimick deceived him regarding the physical condition of his opponent.
I didn't say he was fat.
He's fat. Well, fat chef.
Say that.
He's not fat.
I didn't say that.
It was P-H-A-T.
Oh, sound like a rapper. Yo, yo, fat.
At that point in the contest, Mr. Faxon had little reason to complain. He'd won the first game of the match and seemed to have the shorter, stouter Ming on the run, but Mr. Tsai came back in games 2 and 3.
Championship ball.
When the golfer who regularly wins more than $1 million a year had shaken hands with the shorter, stouter victor, I asked Brad Faxon which would be the more attractive proposition, a rematch with Mr. Tsai or a Sunday playoff with Tiger Woods.
Definitely more with me. I'd rather play 19th hole and a third set. And a nightcap, probably.
Yeah. You'd like to get him out on the golf course, is what you're saying.
He talks. Tiger doesn't talk.
Yeah. Ming Tsai was basking in the crowd's approval after the exhibition, and no wonder. He'd beaten a professional athlete, albeit not at the pro athlete's game.
There must be a certain,
I beat the 11th best golfer in the world right now. And I'm riding high. I'm going to probably take 2 weeks off. I think I deserve a little vacation, and I'm certainly not going to play squash again because I might as well end on a high note.
Equally delighted with the exhibition was referee Mike Riley, though he was happy that the competitors had agreed to an abbreviated format for their battle.
You know, that's probably as much as I can deal with. It's, all those tough decisions I had to make today, it's a good start for me to get into the swing of things for the big pros coming from Europe.
The big pros, of whom referee Riley speaks, will be gathering for the U.S. Open squash tournament, for which Faxon B. Tsai has been the sputtering pace car. The Open begins on September 12th. Last year's tournament was postponed following the events of September 11th and played some months later in a Boston hotel. But this year, as tournament director John Nimick explains, the Open will occur where it was supposed to happen last fall, in Boston Symphony Hall.
It would be fantastic if we had 500 non-squash players come to see it. And that's really one of the reasons we're at Symphony Hall, is so that when someone who's a squash player says to a friend who doesn't play squash, hey, you want to go see the U.S. Open? And they go, well, I'm not really into squash. And then you follow up by saying, oh, it's at Symphony Hall, that maybe that person will come. Maybe that person will come be introduced to squash.
See, when you started,
talking that way. I thought you were going to say you were hoping that numbers of people would come in expecting to hear the Boston Symphony Orchestra, and then they'd stay because what the heck, they were there anyway, even though it was a squash tournament.
Well, we thought about hoodwinking the audience as well, but we kind of gave it up. Gave it up early on.
Probably a good decision, because the game played at the highest level is fast and entertaining. Five of the top six players in the world are expected to compete in this year's Open, including defending champion Peter Nicol of England, the number one player in the world. Promoting such an attraction shouldn't require hoodwinking. In fact, the game played at the level Brad Faxon and Ming Tsai generated in Wednesday's match was also entertaining. Ming Tsai, the victor, as it happened, wanted to make sure that the nearly non-existent press at the event made no mistakes spelling his name.
T-S-K-I. You are the star all the time. Short for F-A-T.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Tad Curry. We had help this week from Athena Desai and from Mary Edwards at member station KWMU in St. Louis. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear our program again or sign up for our newsletter, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig, who at yesterday's press conference was asked if he knew what time players and owners had come to an agreement.
To be frank with you, I lost track of time about 2 o'clock yesterday afternoon. I'm not exactly sure what time it is right now.
Well, you got about 4 years to catch up on your sleep, Commissioner. Then you'll be doing all this again. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, educating discerning patients and dentists since 1985 about their options for the replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is WBUR. Come. This is WBUR. Come.